Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsession
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Hi, it's Jackie Cation. Welcome to the Dork Forest. You know the websites, JackieCation.com, DorkForest.com, TheDorkForest.com, FamilyPetAncestry.com, just because. And it made me laugh, I tell you. Anyway, let's do the credits. Mike Rickberg composed and sang the song with his wife, Sarah Cohen, in the beginning of the program. Mike will sing his words to the Mexican hat dance at the end of the program. Vilmos fixes my website, JackieCation.com, and Patrick Brady fixes the audio. So I appreciate all of their good works. If you go to JackieCation.com, you can have all of the things. You can get my calendar of when I'm doing stand-up. You can watch me do stand-up on Conan or some old clips that are on the video page. You can you can watch the trailer for my current hour special that is available on comedyfilmnerds.com for download, or a regular DVD that you could buy on JackieCation.com. The DVD is the only thing available. You could download it on Comedy Film Nerds, or you can get the DVD, and those are your choices with the This Will Make an Excellent Horcrux video. If you want the CD, you can get that at JackieCation.com, but you could also get it on Amazon or iTunes. You probably listen to it for free on Prodigy? I think not. Pandora? Spotify? Anyway, the merch page, the store page on JackieCation.com has t-shirts. It has hoodies. I have all the hoodies in stock if you want. I went and I bought 3 XXs. So if you want a hoodie and you don't want to, there's no back order right now. They are toddler made, but they're very cozy. So I wasn't going to keep them in stock. Here we go. Other than that, on JackieCation.com and DorkForest.com, there's a donation button. Feel free to donate if you enjoy the show and you have some money. I would love to get a donation from people. You could do it monthly. I haven't made that easy. You'd have to remember that you like the show every month. And I like the idea of everyone sending me $10 a month for 10 months a year, or just $100, or hundreds and hundreds of dollars if you are Oprah and you love the show that much. This is March, and this week, holy crap, I am doing my high school. I'm doing stand-up comedy at the South Milwaukee Performing Arts Center. South Milwaukee is a town of 22,000 people outside of Milwaukee. We have our own water treatment plant. Flint might want to look into that. Anyway, it's a small town. It's a small town, and the high school put in a real nice theater, and they're calling it the Performing Arts Center, and I am putting up a Wisconsin comedy show with Mary Mack, who's from northern Wisconsin, and Tom Clark, who is from Milwaukee, and myself, and a juggler guy who's from Madison that Rachel Source, who books the thing, knows. I don't know him. I'm sure he's very nice, and he can juggle, and that'll be fun for all of us. Anyway, that's not the thing I'm worried about. I'm doing the high school assembly. Remember assemblies in high school? Anyway, I'll do a dork addendum and tell you exactly how that went, because that's silly. Or I'll talk about it on the comedy podcast I'm doing with Lori Kilmartin over at Nerdist called The Jackie and Lori Show, if you guys want to listen to me bitch about stand-up. This is the Dork Forest, though. So we're going to dork out about something cool in just a minute. Other than that, because I'm doing South Milwaukee, and then I'm doing whatever. Other shows, you could find it at JackieCation.com. So I think that's it, except for the Amazon banner. Feel free to use the Amazon banner on JackieCation.com. Let's get into the show already. Hey, it's Jackie Cation. I'm in my living room, you guys. And here I am in Van Nuys doing the Dork Forest with Sovereign Sire, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
All right. We met doing a storytelling show over at the Nerd Melt.
Yes, that was my first time on stage.
Right. You had never done spoken word on stage or any of that.
Mm-mm.
It went well.
I thought it was a little long. I ran a little long.
Right, right. You did. If I remember correctly, you did run a little long.
It was like 26 minutes.
Jesus H. Christ. Did no one tell you?
They did, and I warned them. I said, I've been practicing it at home, and I can't seem to get it down, you know.
Right. Did you, I forget, I do a fair number of these storytelling shows myself, but I like the ones that have it all written. Like, they're like, hey, you should write it out, and then you read it. But this was one that didn't want it written, right?
Yeah, they're very, like, they're very
loosey
weird about
goosey,
that.
Loosey goosey, man.
Yeah.
We want it to be. And you're like, well, then it might be 26 minutes.
Yeah.
Because I forget where I'm going, and then I weed off. And
yeah.
Yeah.
And plus, I think the story I chose to tell was also just very involved, because it was like this.
I think it took years, didn't
yeah.
it? Wasn't it,
it yeah,
a
it's like a story. It was a story about falling in love with a con man. So it was like having to like, and then this layer, and then this layer, and then you know, and like
you started in Florida, you went to New York, you went back to Florida, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it was like so. I was like this story requires quite a considerable amount of context.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
and then I got a bot fly.
And then you got a bot fly, which also you were down in South America or Mexico or something.
Yeah.
Where was it?
Belize.
That was it. Okay. So Sovereign Sire, you guys, it's at Sovereign Sire on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And Sovereign is spelled like Sovereign. Sire is S-Y-R-E.
Mm-hmm.
And ilovesov.com is your blog and main website.
Yeah.
S-O-V. ilovesov.com. And you have a podcast on iTunes.
You
Observations
couldn't.
By Sovereign Sire.
Yeah.
On iTunes. So there you go, folks. And we are going to talk about the history of the world, essentially. It's Western society. Okay.
It's a very specific. So this originally started as a 7-novel series I was going to do. I had left school and I kind of didn't know what I was going to do with my life. And I got,
but you wanted to write fiction?
Well, I was always a writer, and it was more like it was kind of the only skill I had, you know? So, I left when I realized I didn't want to be a teacher. I was a TA. I hated it. And I realized like, oh, this is it. Like, this is what you do.
Right.
And then you write on the side. So I had left and I was kind of wandering and I came across, I was a double major in sociology and English lit in my undergrad.
Yeah.
So I had always been very interested.
Where'd you go?
Fresno State.
There you go. People should know.
Yeah. And actually the poetry program I came out of, the last two poet laureates of the United States trained and taught there.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah. So like
I have
it was
a friend who teaches theater at Fresno State, actually.
What's her name?
It's a man. His name is Chris. Hey, Chris, you're listening. And I spaced your name. He's married to Jim Keller. Chris Boltz, B-O-L-T-Z. There you go. If you have Professor Boltz at Fresno State, say hi and tell him we should get together and play some Pathfinder. Okay, bye.
So I left school and I was reading Michel Foucault wrote a book called Discipline and Punish, which was about the history of the penal system.
Oh, wow.
And I got really interested in because he's a philosopher. So his approach to history was kind of including a lot of like social elements, you know, and it was about how we interact with history, how we interact with knowledge, with power, all that kind of stuff. And he was sort of talking about, if you look at the history of the penal system, you get all this stuff about the human condition, like, and our relationship to knowledge.
That sounds fat. What's the name of it?
Discipline and Punish. And it's,
what's the author?
Michel Foucault.
F-U-C-O?
It's F-O-U-C-A-U-L-T. He's French.
Okay. There we go.
Of course. He's a
Michel
French
guy. Michel Foucault.
Okay. But, so he had been talking about, I just became obsessed with this idea of, how much you can learn about the past by studying sort of these social institutions that we create and how much,
That's serious insight.
Yeah. Like I think because being a woman and I loved history, but you know, women's stories throughout history they're not told by us. They're not really concerned with us.
Right. They're mostly lost.
Yeah. And, so in this book, there was like a footnote to a footnote about the last guy that was publicly executed in France. But the footnote to the footnote was, it was this guy, De Quillonne, that was a priest who had gotten his girlfriend pregnant and didn't want to get caught by the church. And in a weird kind of suicide pact gone wrong, he killed her, then chickened out, you know, cut up the body, and, you know, and then it was like a long, you know, like, and, but I
what
was,
year was that?
It was 1824.
Okay.
And I became interested in the story of that woman. Like what, you know,
Who is that lady
that has
who's
an affair
with
a priest and, you know, entrusts her life to him and all this. So that kind of got me interested in this idea. Like I wanted to tell that story. I was like, oh, maybe I could do like sort of a fictionalized, like a historical fiction novel about that. Like that'd be really great, you know? And in studying that, I came across all this information about the French Revolution because, you know, this all happened sort of after the revolution. And
but there was a series of French revolutions during the 1800s, right?
Right.
And 1824 was when Marquis de Lafayette came and did his last visit to the United States. He came back from, he was the last, one of the last generals left over from the Revolutionary War.
Right, right.
And so he did like a 13 or a 15 state tour that lasted 18 months. And yeah. he, and people wrote songs about him, and Lafayette went all over the United States and people lost their tiny lizard minds about him.
Yeah.
Anyway, but so, 34 was the next, I think, French Revolution, but you're talking about the one in 1889?
I'm talking about 1789.
1789?
Yeah. Okay. Because he come from this place, Lyon. And like that had during the French Revolution, there'd been a lot of like counter revolutions and a lot of just like massacres and brutality. There's a guy, Jean-Baptiste Carrier, that was a general. Well, he was sent out as like a proconsul during the revolution to kind of put down this like counter revolution that was happening out in the provinces.
Wow.
And he had kept a diary.
Okay.
Of his basically his descent into madness. He was sent out there to sort of pacify this counter-revolution
yeah.
and ended up like imprisoning thousands and thousands of people and would get these letters like, you have to just like kill everybody, like execute
oh, wow.
them all. And Hitler got some of his ideas for how he was executing Jews from Carrier's like
how
journals.
How do you spell Carrier, by the way?
Carrier.
Okay, like, there we go. And so...
So then I was like, this thing was like... What was getting me was how like this the social impact of these things, like the guy had killed his girlfriend because it was one of the few ways for an uneducated guy or for a poor guy to like get an education and get some sort of power in this world was to be
a priest.
But that meant he had to take on all of this other shit, which is like, you know, to be
celibacy
and all of that, right? And I became interested in how these like basically, these social institutions like had created the situation in
right.
which this terrible crime had occurred, and
right.
it was all about people just wanting to have access to power or to rise above their circumstances,
yeah.
right? And as I went back through the revolution, I just became interested in this idea, and so the first idea I had was I wanted to do like a series of novels because I was like, oh, what if I like went back like generations and you could sort of see how generationally different love stories are affected by the social circumstances in which they're occurring.
Yeah.
And then also like tell it sort of from a female point of view, like get into sort of the lesser known history of women.
Yeah.
And the, like the dirty underbelly of history. I thought that
right.
was like an interesting thesis. Like,
yeah. And I think it has been traditionally the purpose of historical fiction is to try to go back and tell those stories of women
mm-hmm.
that were never told.
Yeah.
They're just like, you know, there were women back then. That's
yeah.
why there's still people.
And it's like for me, what was really interesting in researching these, as I started kind of formulating like what I wanted to cover and the scope and the breadth of what I wanted to do, I found that even researching these stories, it's like you had to be very creative in getting the information you wanted. Like, I read a lot of midwife manuals to get a sense of what society was like.
Yeah.
Because no one's writing about women's intimate lives. But if you go read an old midwife's manual and you start to see how she's writing about sex and how she's
yeah.
writing about conception, you start to go like, oh, like you can almost build a culture around that where you're like, oh, so this is how women must have talked to each other because
okay.
it's like, this is what's being addressed.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
And those were the only diaries that were
yeah.
being kept, kind of.
Yeah. But there's,
wow.
there's an herbal remedy for a bad husband.
Oh,
which
really?
Which is essentially to poison him. Like, but they had,
sure.
they had abortifacients.
I laugh.
But they talk about, the clit. That was super surprising. There's a midwife manual that's talking about if your wife's not getting pregnant, maybe she's not having orgasms, that's how she becomes more fertile.
Right.
So here's how you do it. She has this little part and
she's
you need to
get on it.
Yeah. But like that's in a midwife manual, like
yeah.
from 1804.
It's like, yeah. So
it's really kind of like, it was really like, interesting.
That is.
You know?
Yeah. That's fascinating.
Yeah. Like, so, and the other thing was, you know, people always dismiss, I think fiction about women or stories about women as like historical fiction is like, oh, is it a bodice ripper? And so I also felt like I have this pedigree.
Yeah.
I have like a literary pedigree.
Mm-hmm.
I want to start to write some stories that like our literature.
Yeah.
Like, it kind of pisses me off that the minute the story's about a woman, someone's like, oh, it's historical
Yeah, it's just a stupid romance novel.
Yeah.
And you're like, you know what? I think all rangers of the Dork Forest know that I read romance novels. I will read a romance novel, but they're very specific. And I mostly read historical fiction, historical romance novels.
Yeah.
Which are set oftentimes in countries where I don't know the history very well,
mm-hmm.
just because if the research is bad, I am not distracted. Then I can just go, oh, that's a nice story. But what I love, quite honestly, about romance novels is the socio-political message mm-hmm. in every shitty novel that anyone's ever written, there is always a B-plot of an agenda. Yeah. Whether you're reading a James Patterson novel mm-hmm. or you're reading a Stephanie Lawrence novel, mm-hmm. there's a socio-political message, which is, in a Stephanie Lawrence novel, it's tolerance. It's,
right.
hey, why don't you, family's very important. Why don't you deal with it and mm-hmm. it'll be fine. I mean, there's always a message in yeah. all fiction and because everybody's politics or everybody's how they deal with society comes out, whether it's right wing or left wing mm-hmm. or fascist or socialist or whatever it is, it's going to come out.
Yeah.
Well, you can't hide it.
Yeah. And I think that like in the stories that I was writing, like the theme kept being like power. You know,
yeah,
like power struggles, like
yeah.
how people deal with not having power.
Yeah.
You know, and how they try to get around it.
Yeah.
And so I ended up like mapping it back. So I just started to learn about this. Like, it's a very specific window in history, but I just got really like,
you started getting more and more specific.
It. Yeah. Yeah. And so I realized that I wanted to, because I started to see like a through line. And what the through line was
back from 1824, just mm-hmm. going back in time,
all the way back. And I was like, the through line is the age of discovery. It's Columbus landing in, you know, Hispaniola and the Spanish conquest of a new world. And at the same, like from there, all of those events led up to the age of enlightenment, which is when.
So the age of discovery just sort of grabbed you and Columbus particularly.
Well, I guess, but it was like going backwards because like, okay, Age of Enlightenment, like what started that? And so then I kind of started looking back and you start looking at like the war of religion, you start looking at, but a lot of it was like these wars that were really about land in the new world and access to those resources.
Right.
And so it's like, but that all brought about, you know, this long series of events brought about like a paradigm shift in human consciousness, which led us from magical thinking to like a meritocracy.
Well, and science, and then to, yeah, and didactic, and yeah, I get it.
Yeah. So I was like, well, what if I did a series of stories that kind of tracked, like, say, one family over 7 or 8 generations kind of moving through these changes?
Oh, yeah.
You know, and wouldn't that be interesting?
That would be interesting.
And what if I told them, like, where female characters were sort of these predominant characters and not necessarily always the heroine?
Yeah.
Like, you know, and so I decided to start with the Spanish conquest of Florida because I started looking to him like, when did we really get like a foothold in America? And it wasn't necessarily when Ponce de Leon found Florida, but it was when the Spanish decided that they were going to
settle
and
harvest.
Yeah. But it also started with women. Cause so what happened was,
yeah.
There was the war of religion was going on, and the Huguenots, the
oh right, the British,
the
Normandy,
the Protestants,
yeah, the Protestants.
So the Protestants,
Reformation,
were not safe in France,
right.
which was a Catholic country. Catherine de Medici was sort of the mother-in-law that was kind of
yeah.
all up in it.
I have, by the way, access to some of these names in my head, and I'm like, it's sort of 13, I don't know when. Anyway, so if anyone is yelling at their iPod because they happen to know more about this, listen to a different fucking episode,
because
we are going to meander around some historical dates if I need to.
We're going
to
fudge some stuff.
And it'll be fun, because we're talking about the bigger issue, and it's fascinating. Okay.
So one of the things of all the stories that I've written is like that it's things aren't what you think they are. Like people think that slavery was like, well, it was like the times. And I'm like, Bartholomew de las Casas was this guy. I think it was like the late 1500s, early 1600s, that was petitioning like the Pope and stuff, saying like, we need to treat slaves better. Like, slavery is wrong.
Yeah.
Like, so the idea that like, oh, people accepted slavery and then one day they didn't. It's like, no, like since its inception, it has been a hotly debated issue among like the cultures in which it exists. Like, people have always had an ethical problem with it.
Yeah. People have always had an ethical, I mean, back to everywhere, Byzantine times. It doesn't matter if you're in Persia, in BC, the Jews, not psyched about being slaves. The people who kept them as slaves had some issues and didn't want to have slaves. Not all of them. So, that's fascinating. So who was the guy who petitioned?
Bartolomeo de las Casas. It's a Spanish name.
Yeah, yeah.
When Florida was first found, the reason that Spain didn't like get a foothold in that was because the natives were too hostile. So this whole thing about like that, like Indians were just like, oh my God, you're amazing gods. Like that wasn't happening in Florida. They were like, fuck you.
Fuck you. You're taking our land.
they fought. They were better fighters. They were guerrilla fighters. And also like,
what tribe is that? What were some of the tribes?
Many different tribes. It's mainly accepted that the Timucua Indians were who they encountered. They were like tall, covered in tattoos, and looked a lot like something that might come out of the Amazon.
Okay, you know, so they were from South America originally, but migrated up?
They think so.
But they were giant Native Americans.
They were
big time warriors.
If you look at the French like had a different approach for colonization. So the French were very curious about the people that they were trying to live with. And so, among the colonists that came over from France, there were artists and what we would call, I guess, sociologists or naturalists that would go out and like sketch them. And so there's some famous, I think the guy's name is Fry, Flemish engraver that kind of engraved over these illustrations, and they became very famous. So you can go online and look up Timucua and you'll see.
How do you spell Timucua?
Timucua.
Got it.
If you like, you'll see these famous kind of like they're covered in tattoos. They're very tall, and like the Spanish and the French look like really tiny next to them. But it shows them playing lacrosse, hunting alligators, barbecuing, barbacoa. That's where we get the term barbecue.
Okay.
So where was I going with that? So the natives, like the first thing
they didn't just roll over and hand people corn.
They were cannibals. Yeah. They were also amazing athletes. They were farmers. They had
all the parts of society, is what you're saying?
They
did they have a written language or no?
No. They had realms. They lived along the rivers that are all over Florida.
A lot of trading.
Yeah. A lot of them spoke Spanish and French because shipwrecks were fairly common. And between Bimini and Cuba and the tip of Florida, like, so there was even like, you know, they had seen white people before. Some could speak the language. There are a couple of stories of Spaniards that shipwrecked and like lived with the Timucua for like 17 years. And then the next ship came by and they like went back home. Like that was kind of like an experience that would happen to people.
Right. Like, so it wasn't like, it wasn't like the Iroquois up north where they were like, who the hell are these guys?
Right.
Well, they're probably, there's not going to be that many of them.
Right.
These, the Floridian, the Native Americans who lived in Florida.
They were like,
oh no, there's a shitload of these guys.
We're talking. We're in a net. And so that was a big thing, was like, they were talking to each other. So they were in a network. They were trading, that the rivers allowed them to have this kind of network in which they could, you know, across the panhandle and whatever.
Wow.
So the Spanish couldn't like get a foothold there. Also the hurricanes, the weather, like everything about it was just like inhospitable, but it was beautiful.
Sure.
So,
and when is this? Is this early 1500s?
So Ponce de Leon, I think it was, don't hold me to this. It was like 1513.
Okay. Early 1500s.
That he landed there. And it wasn't till about 1563, 64 and 65. So what happened there was, so back to the French people, they are fleeing religious persecution or whatever. And so they start trying to get footholds in the New World, like these little colonies. And a little French colony had popped up in what is now Jacksonville, Florida.
Really?
Yeah. And so that was 1563. It was a couple missions there. But they had a different approach to dealing with the natives, which is they studied them, they would communicate with them. They were interested in their culture.
More integration and more working with?
Yeah. Like there's a, René Laudonnier was the guy that was sort of in charge of it. And he wrote a book called Three Voyages, which I read recently, and it almost reads like Anthony Bourdain. It's amazing how it holds up.
Okay.
But it's this kind of going in and like, then they eat this, the women look like that. We encountered some hermaphrodites, which is like there were, among the Timucua, there were people, men could choose to also live as women.
Okay.
And they would dress that way, and they were generally like the healers, the medicine men that would go like during war, because women wouldn't go out on the battlefield. They would be the ones to go out and take care of everybody.
What's the book that the three
voyages
and the name of the author?
René Laudonnier. I'm probably totally.
Well, people can Google it. Google around. Everyone knows that.
So they came over and they basically kind of had a foothold. Like they got in and they had relationships with the natives, with the Timucua, and were doing good. And word got back to Spain that the French had done what the Spanish could not.
Yep.
And so the king at the time was like, now we have to, because they can't beat us at this. And so long story short, he sent this guy Menendez out to said, you can, if you fund the voyage, because they were broke, Spain was broke. So he said, if you fund it, like you can have it. Basically, like you'll be the governor, your family will be set up, it'll be all good, like that kind of stuff.
Right.
And like, so
just get over there.
Yeah. And he's like, the main thing is like, just get rid of the French.
Oh, get rid of the French.
Yeah. Get over there, kick them out. That's our land.
Okay.
Kick them out and establish, you know, a colony there. And because there was also fear that if the French settled in there, there was like piracy was still a big issue. And they're like, if they get like a little spot there, then like piracy, you know, pirates are going to be able to hide there.
Yeah. It's a nice haven.
Yeah. So, when I was reading about this story, I was struck by, so they, landed on August, I'm going to fudge the date. They landed, the Spanish landed in 1565, on, I think it was St. Augustine's feast day. That's why they named it St. Augustine. They settled in a Timucua village called Saloy.
Okay.
Which they turned into San Augustine, which still exists today. And in the midst of probably one of the worst hurricanes on record, they marched 40 miles to the north where the French were. And the French had seen the Spanish coming. So they had sent all their men out on ships to like go meet them.
Yep.
And so they had left their fort basically undefended, just women, children, and sick old people.
Okay.
And so they marched through this hurricane, like slaughtered
over land.
Yeah. Slaughtered everybody. Like, cause they basically like, they saw the hurricane coming and they're like, if we bank on going on foot, they're probably going to send people like, cause they had seen each other. They're going to send their people this way.
They're going to think we're going to go out to sea.
Right.
So we can
do it this way. And it's like, well, one fell swoop and it worked. And when I was reading the narrative though, they were talking about like, but they saved the women and children. And then, you know, like, brought them back down to St. Augustine. Like
the Spanish did not kill the women and children.
Well, that's what they said.
Yeah.
and so I tried to look up all this information I could about like what happened to those people like that. And there was like nothing. I was like, well, what would happen to someone would they
just be then integrated into Spanish society? Because I mean, first of all, they saved the women and children. I don't know that I believe that.
I don't think they did. I think that because they, how are you going to feed,
you got to march them back 40 miles in hurricane season.
Yeah.
And in the north, the British were burning the Pequot alive.
Right.
So
no mercy. I just don't buy it.
They were French, so maybe, but not, maybe three people.
Right.
I mean, they might have saved like a handful of people, but that's not.
Yeah. And I was like, it's amazing how women just disappear. And then there was like, I was reading a book about Menendez and about his journeys over. And there was like a footnote to a footnote. And it was talking about, a soldier in St. Augustine that got in trouble for talking to a prostitute by the fountain in the center of town. And I'm like, that's interesting because in all the, and all the information accounting for which colonists were coming over to St. Augustine, I didn't see any whores listed.
Right, right. Like, they weren't on the manifest.
Yeah. So I was like, okay, so it was there, but just no one's talking about it.
Yeah.
And whores are like, that's like most women that were doing anything interesting were nuns or whores.
Right. Like, right. It was the only people earning any living.
Yeah.
Right. The nuns were reading everything and right. the whores were meeting everyone.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And yeah. so I was like, what about those stories? And so like, that's when I got hooked in. I was like, okay, I've got the story. I'm gonna tell a story of a Spaniard that saves one woman. Like one woman gets okay. saved and she's a French woman and like, they're going to go native. They're going to go into the wilderness together and they're going to have a love story.
Okay.
And so like, that's kind of like how it started, but it was like, it led
you down thousands of pages of historical nonfiction.
Yeah.
Right.
But I think it was the idea of like, I wanted to tell that story of like, okay, if you were a woman and you survived a raid on right. something like that, what realistically would happen to you? You know,
well,
like
you would get raped at right. least once,
right.
By one person and then right. the next guy,
yeah.
I assume, right? Who's like, meh, I'll do that too. Until you met someone who didn't want, I mean, I'm sure that at the same time, there were men who did not rape people.
Right.
And it was, but I cannot imagine that those women were not attacked.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the thing where it's like, you've got large groups of men that have been at sea for 2 to 3 months to get there. And then they get there and unless they're married, they weren't allowed to just bring somebody. So it's like, right. they're going to take advantage of the spoils.
Right. They're going to be looking for work, love, something.
Yeah.
Orifice, I think is the word I'm looking for. But that's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, that's kind of, that's how it started. Like, and so I wanted to write that as a graphic novel because I also.
Oh, okay. So that's what you're working on now.
Yeah. So I wanted to do, I had the idea to make the stories kind of match the time in which they exist. And I thought a graphic novel would be an interesting way to.
Sort of an illustrated.
Yeah. Because I'm like, well, people aren't. Like, there's a lot of magical realism. Like, by the time it's to the last story in the series, I've plotted it out so that it's written in very much like a realistic, like, there's nothing magic is happening. And in the first story, all kinds of magical stuff happens. Like,
okay.
people can see things and, like, there are messages from God. And because I wanted it to kind of match, in a way, like, the time.
Right,
like,
and the educational arc. Or the way that humanity was actually going forth.
Yeah.
So when does the first one start in, like, 1492?
The first one starts in 15... The action of the story starts in 1565.
Okay.
But it's told through a series of flat... Like, there's a series of... I also wanted to do a graphic novel because the first novel was going to... I knew it was going to involve a lot of kind of, like, not even flashbacks, but, like, okay, stop, now we're going to go back... It's 1492 and it's the conquistador's grandfather.
Okay.
You know, and we're going to tell this little slice of a story.
Which can be done in comics a lot easier.
Yeah.
Than...
Yeah. And so, because it was like when I went to write it, like that.
Oh, you need
a
nice sepia wash. You put a nice sepia wash over that's part of the graphics. It's, I see what's happening. We're back in time.
Well, yeah. Because it's like the thing I liked about From Hell was that Alan Moore was able to incorporate like a lot of history and arcane stuff just by kind of going like, okay, in this chapter, we're just going to do a tour of London and we're just going to have this guy narrating. This kind of weird offshoot of
it's the greatest
history.
Thing about comic books, quite honestly,
yeah.
is that they can be about anything,
yeah,
and you can do them in any damn way you want to do them,
yeah,
because no one's watching. It's like stand-up comedy to some extent. I mean, no one is paying attention. There's 100 people that might care, unless it goes huge,
right?
And so you might as well do the thing you want to do.
Yeah, well, and I feel like too, you know, in writing about history, it's like if I'm writing about. From 1783 to 1792, like an incredible amount of change happens in like one culture.
It's a decade.
And like, but it's incredible amount of political change happens, you know, like a king is beheaded. Like we're no longer acknowledging, you know, like.
Yeah, monarchies
like,
fall.
Like they kicked out the church,
right?
like it was illegal to believe in God for a minute. Like that's a huge amount of change in 10 years. But and that's because of the printing, like because of all these other cultural changes that are going on. Whereas you know, if I'm writing about from 1492 to 1604, it takes almost like 100 years to have the same kind of change go on within like a culture.
Right.
In terms of like how they're interacting with each other and how they're interacting with their world.
Yeah.
And
the world has tightened up a lot. I mean,
yeah.
the changes got a lot faster because of the technology.
Yeah.
Like the whole printing press and that business.
Yeah.
The business with the printing press.
Well, that's why, like, the first story, like, I knew that, like, I was going to have to be accounting for sort of, like, much larger tracks of time to kind of, like, I have a flashback because there's certain, like, themes that run through it. So there's a flashback in the story where we get in, like, a few pages the story of the conquest of the Inca, because it's like important to understand, like, this is how Spanish people would like normally take over a country. Mm-hmm. This is kind of normally what the fallout would be. Like it was
all
like,
all I know about the Incans was they made roads without, any sort of mortar. Like they didn't, they carved stones so tightly.
Yeah.
And that they were great runners.
Mm-hmm.
Peru, right?
Yeah, because you had to convey information to get messages, like,
right.
Quickly.
They were marathon runners, essentially. Yeah.
Yeah.
Super
high altitude.
Right. So it's Peru. Mm-hmm. So that is the western side of South America.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It is mountain ranges, right?
If you go up to, like, Bolivia and Colombia and in these places, it's like, it's very mountainous.
Okay.
And then Lima, Peru is like, it's literally like right on, like, the edge.
It's on a cliff overlooking an ocean, right?
Yeah, like
the
jutting headlands, you know? So it's like, yeah. There's like a lot of plains, there's mountains. And then as you get towards the Amazon, there's like these deep gorges where, like, the Amazon is cut through. And then as you go along the Amazon, then it becomes more forested. And
was the Incan Empire, did it go up into Colombia?
Yes. So the way the Inca were kind of like the Borg.
Hello, Star Trek.
Yeah.
Good,
like,
work.
We're going to get in there. So the Inca were like the Borg. So the way that they would deal with, like, so when the Spanish arrived, the reason they were able to defeat the Inca so quickly was because the Inca was already in the midst of, like, a civil war. It was like two feuding brothers that were, like, both, the emperor, basically, like, vying for power.
Yep.
And the Inca civilization was actually the Borg. They had sort of arisen and then would kind of take over villages, village by village. They would sort of take over any kind of, you know, like the way that the American Indians were easily defeated was the tribes didn't ever really have, like,
anything cohesive.
So the Inca basically fixed that, right? So the Inca was actually a network of tons of conquered people.
Right.
That had, and so what they would do is they would conquer you.
Hello.
They would take anything useful that your people could do.
Mm-hmm.
And they would, like, integrate you. Into the cap, they, like, bring you to the capital. They integrate that.
Oh, like Christianity.
Yeah,
where they're like, that pagan ritual. Yeah, you like that one?
Yeah.
We'll keep it. That's
fine. And then they would transport you. Like, if you were, like, one of the people in the novels, the Chachapoya, which were like the cloud walkers, and they were like these blonde, blue eyed, like, medicine people that lived kind of to the north of Lima, and because of their position on the river, they did a lot of trades, so they knew all about herbs and what medicines worked for what. And so people thought they were very, like, shamanistic people.
Okay.
And so, like, they would be taken and then they would be sent, like, 40 miles north or south.
Okay.
So they would be in completely unfamiliar, like,
it would disorient them.
So they couldn't, like, they couldn't rebel. Like,
they couldn't regroup.
Yeah. And
okay.
So, like, that's why I say, like, the Borg. It's like they kind of eat it and then, like, and then integrate everybody and kind of
redistribute it so that they could take away their power, essentially, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Because so they didn't leave people to incite rebellion in their own homes.
Right.
Because you know where to hide in your own valleys and villages.
Right.
You do not if you – it's like slavery.
Yeah.
When we brought all the slaves over from Africa, they couldn't go back.
Yeah.
And they were all from different tribes.
Yeah.
And so they couldn't – it was hard to create anything cohesive out of that.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. So, but when the Spanish came over, when Pizarro came over, it was
already kind of in decline.
There were two brothers, Atahualpa and his brother were like fighting over, like, who was really in charge, because when you have an empire that vast, you know, it's like you start to have these divisions. Like, they're naturally going to occur where it's like you've got the brother that's like the runner up for power that's like been put in charge of the southern part of the empire, and
so
now
he's emperor.
Right. It's like, so there's already that infighting, and then the Spanish arrive, you know, relatively, like, not prepared to deal with the whole empire, but they came in, abducted Atahualpa, and ransomed him for gold or whatever. But it, like, they did it so fast. It's like they came in on their horses, they dazzled, whatever. They got him, and the people were like, holy shit, like, he got our emperor. Like, they must be fucking powerful.
Right.
You know, and so, and
because no one had been able to unseat any of these people for how long was the Incan Empire? Was it 100 years?
I think, if I'm remembering right, like, they think that the Incan Empire, like, kind of emerged probably around the same time that Columbus discovered but encountered the Taino people in the Caribbean. So they think like 1400s.
That's when it
kind of like, we're an empire. Like, we're the Inca now. We're going to do this thing.
Okay. So that's when it kind of started. And yeah. When did what's his face come and snatch out of?
He arrived in, he had conquered them and he had established Lima, Peru by 1535.
Okay.
So
40 years, 50 years.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is, so once they, the way that they were able to sustain that defeat, though, was because people like the Chachapoya, these defeated tribes, like, started to help the Spanish fight the Inca, because they were like, fuck those guys.
Right. Let's get out of this.
Yeah. But it's a testament to, like, how much environment also plays a role in that kind of stuff, which is because the roads are narrow and high and deeply forested, the Spanish were never able to really make any headway like inland, because the terrain was just too difficult.
Yeah.
To get in there and like.
So did they attack from the Pacific, from the sea?
Yeah.
From the ocean? Mm-hmm. Okay.
They landed, like, Atahualpa came out with this whole retinue or whatever, and like, it was like four Spaniards, you know?
And like, they were like, that guy seems important. Let's grab him.
And they basically, did a little skirmishing. And it was also like Atahualpa's fault, because I'm going to fudge the history here, but there was something where it's like he either had a seer or a dream or something. It was like he believed so much in his own God imbued power that, like,
a little arrogant.
Because everyone was saying, like, if he had just sent a messenger instead, if he had just, like, waited, it's like they outnumbered the Spanish, like, 1,000,000 to 1.
Right.
You know, and like, but he was so cocky in that God had chosen him to rule that he went himself.
Yeah.
That he just showed up, like, it'll be nothing. And, like, and wasn't prepared for, like, guns and horses and shiny armor, like, you know, and all this kind of stuff that basically just scared the shit out of all of his
dudes,
all of his fighters. They had never seen a horse before, like, that, you know, like, that was, or metal. I mean, like armor like that, you know, like that kind of iron and iron tools and all that.
And that
stuff.
Weird helmet business and all that must have just sort of freaked, because it was so very foreign.
And like, I think it's just, you know, culturally, you know, you don't defy the king, but because they don't recognize his kingship, it's like they're walking right up to a god and touching him, you know. It's like, and I think people are just like, whoa, they must be really powerful because they're committing this taboo, which is they're even talking to this guy.
Yeah,
you know,
you're not even supposed to. It's like Oprah. You're not supposed to look at her.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. You know, so so that's that. So there's, like, you know, but like, understanding that becomes like, I wanted to write a story where it's like we incorporate all of these things so you can see how all of these things, like, come together at a point in time and then create a situation where, you know, like, these sites of struggle, these power struggles, you know, but it's like,
and it's on every continent and it's in every culture, but the cultures are so different that the fact that, you know, you end up a rabbit hole of Spanish history following, like, Spanish conquest.
Yeah.
When everything I've read has followed English conquest for some reason, I have no idea. But now you also were interested in French, right?
Yeah.
What happened? How does that go?
Because I, like,
what do you got there?
Because as I was working backwards, I wanted it to be sort of inclusive of, like, well, I'm French. My mom's French. So it's like,
from France, or you have French ancestry?
French. Her father's born in France and she was. It is ancestry, but like very.
Second generation.
Very, very immediate. Like.
Yeah, like my Armenian, whatever.
Yeah.
All like, my grandparents,
super immediate.
Are from somewhere.
Yeah. I went to France to meet my French half of the family. So it's like still in living memory kind of thing. He was also really into history. When I when I was there visiting, he pulled out like all of these binders where he had tracked back our family history down to like the 1400s.
Wow.
Like, this is where you come from. He had a great deal of pride for him. Like, this is where we come from. This is the village we're from. This is the chateau that we owned.
Right.
This is like, you know, you're like I'm the last carrier of the mitochondrial DNA of, Joseph Hart, that was the New Jersey representative that signed the Declaration of but I know that, like, for him it was like, you, like, if you don't have kids, like,
yeah,
like, it dies with you, you know. Like,
that kind of. I'm sorry, I heard the word midichlorians when you said
mitochondria,
which is a Star Wars, horrible Star Wars thing, but yes, fair enough, I think. So, okay, so you have a vested interest in sort of French history.
Yeah, and then I think the way it came to Spanish was because I wanted the stories to always end up being coming sort of, I wanted it to be coming back to America. And I think I was just like, well, the Spanish were the first people here, so let's look at it. And I was like, oh, no, no, no. The French were the first one to, like, really get in there.
Right.
So it did be, like, it was French history to me. It was like, okay,
right,
like, let's take a French person, and then, like,
yeah,
like, kind of follow, like, this generational thing, you know. And then I always just had a thing with American history because, you know, people always say that we don't have a culture here, that we don't have a history, that we're a baby. And I'm always like, we have, like, this rich and amazing history, and it's, like, really well documented, like, better documented than most, because there was so much financial, like, I could find documents that were, like, a slave was the modern equivalent of about $20,000. Like, the first time, like the first use of the word cracker, like, was, I think it was like 1624 in a doc. Like we have these documents because we were dealing with money and all this kind of stuff where.
So people,
there's so much documentation of
500 years of history of the North America is so much better documented than the last 5,000 years in Europe.
In terms of especially for if you're interested in like the social interaction between like the history of private life, which I think is what makes history compelling.
Yeah.
Is when it becomes.
I love that term. The history of private life is an awesome.
Yeah. And it's like, I think that's what, you know, makes history compelling and interesting to people, you know. And it's like the boyfriends I've had or girlfriends I've had as I've been like drafting out these story ideas will be like, well, tell me what happens to Una or whatever. And it's like they're invested because it's a story. It's like relatable. Like,
and yeah, history is much more interesting when you look at the people.
Yeah.
If you just look at events and dates and stuff like that, which is unfortunately what a lot of history classes can be.
Yeah.
But those are not the best history classes. The best history classes, I think one of my favorite history classes in college was the history of science. And it explained different scientific theory from the perspective of the scientist who had discovered it. Well, I don't have any of that information anymore. But at the time, I was drawn into it. I was made more interested in science than I had ever been before. Because I'm not a particularly, so I mean I like the idea of science. I certainly believe in climate change,
right.
But and I certainly know that there are scientists out there who are very smart and about these things, and they're not lying.
Right. No,
we're not living in the crucible, people. People are not just coming up with shit.
Right.
So just to scare. I mean, people are coming up with shit just to scare you, but it isn't climate change.
Yeah.
So it's I love. History is much more interesting if it is the individual. So,
or when you can imagine yourself in those same circumstances.
Yeah, when you look at sort of the Bill of Lading and the manifests, I mean, it does tell you more about what occurred. Like, if you can get some there are housekeeper accounts which are supposedly very fascinating.
They are, because like for me, like when I was like as I've been working on different novels, like. Obviously, this is like my Leaves of Grass. This is going to be like a lifetime project.
Right.
But the most interesting things come from stuff like that. Like when I was saying, like, you had to be very creative. I wanted to set a scene. So I was like, okay, what would a house look like? What would people be wearing? And how would they talk to each other? And at a certain point, I had to call an antique dealer and say, when did bathtubs, like, what, how, where would that be in the house? Like, what would bathroom look like? And he said, oh, no, no, no. They didn't have bathrooms until, like, well into the 1800s. the most houses would be one or two rooms, and you would move furniture in the room throughout the day to follow the light because you didn't have electricity or oil. Right. Oil was very expensive. And so you would open up the windows and then like where the light was through the day.
You just move your chair around.
Yeah. So he said, he's like,
that's awesome.
Like, beds, like the most expensive item in the house would be the bedstead that would be passed down through generations.
Makes sense.
But yeah, like
I'm a huge fan of lying down.
A table could be the dining table. Then it's the workbench. Then it's just depending on like
the time of day.
Yeah. But he said bathtubs, you would be like in the kitchen or outside and you'd fill it with water and then, you know, everyone would take a turn in the bath or whatever. And like just, I wrote a book called, the Fragrant and the Foul, which was about the history of smell in the French social imagination. The history of smell in the French social imagination.
Okay.
But it was very interesting because one of the characters in the book, I wanted to have like a really keen sense of smell.
Yeah.
And I was like, I realized I don't pay attention to smells very much, like in terms of trying to relate them to like, this smells like this.
Right.
But it kind of,
modern society doesn't smell very much either.
Well, and it's because it's considered like the history of smell is interesting because it's considered sort of a vulgar organ.
The nose?
Yeah.
Interesting.
You know, and because it's the most animal part of our nature. Like I have a thing where it's like if I'm really sexually excited, I'll start to sneeze. And I was always like, didn't know what that was. It was just like a weird thing, right?
Right.
Like if I got really, really turned on, I might start sneezing. And it turns out that like when you're aroused, your nasal tissue swells.
Okay.
And so that can trigger like, what I found out is like a lot of people have that thing where it's like, it can trigger like you start sneezing because your nose thinks it's congested or whatever, but it's just like the tissue in your,
it's like a sensory reaching out.
You're smelling the pheromones. And so one theory is that the reason smell's always been kind of whatever is because it's related. It's our most animal sense. It's like kind of the first thing that we have.
Okay.
And whether we realize it or not, it's actually the thing that triggers our memory the most immediately.
Okay.
And like smell is actually the thing that is like the most primitive part of our brain when we're in interfacing with the environment. The first thing and the most powerful thing that's going to stay with us is the smell of things.
Interesting.
And so like perfumes and like, smell used to be a really big deal back in the day before they had sanitation, before they had all this stuff. So I was reading these things where it was like a doctor was talking about like, oh, the children's ward is the worst.
Yeah.
Oh God, the women's ward. It's so awful, especially if they're on their period. My God. You know, because there was no air conditioning. There was no ventilating system. There was no nothing.
Right.
You know, and there were like, people were still using latrines. And so it was really interesting to see.
And bedpans
like,
underneath the bed
mm-hmm.
that they didn't, then they had to empty.
Yeah.
And you're like,
mm-hmm.
And they didn't know about ventilation.
Mm-hmm.
Holy crap. That sounds very stinky.
Yeah.
That sounds super, super stinky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
so I don't know, but I find little things like this where it's like you find history in weird places and you're able to slowly start to piece together what daily life must have been like.
You know,
when you read like, oh, people didn't drink water so much because they didn't have ways to make it potable.
Yeah.
So they drank something called sour wine, which was like just enough wine in the water to basically keep it purified. So it's just enough alcohol.
Yeah.
So you couldn't really get drunk off of it.
Yeah.
But it was enough to basically keep the water potable.
So it would make it safe.
Yeah.
Yeah. It would kill whatever tiny bacteria, but they didn't know why they were drinking it because they didn't know about tiny bacteria.
Well, yeah. It's like when they figured out that you couldn't dig wells next to latrines, like that took a long time for people to figure out, you know, like just stuff like that.
And they're like, well, let's just put the water next to where all the thing is happening and then it'll all be in the same place.
Well, the bathing was like I went to the Chateau du Versailles and, we were like walking around and they're like, you know, it used to stink really bad because like nobles, they would just go piss in a corner.
Right.
Like that was fine. And like they said, like Louis the 16th or whatever, like he smelled like death. So back in, like all of his family had died of smallpox.
Okay.
So he was definitely afraid of smallpox. And their understanding of medicine was like, if you took a bath, like your pores opened up, which made you susceptible
to
anything kind of coming in.
Okay.
And so he didn't bathe out of like this deathly fear that he would catch smallpox or whatever.
Wasn't he the one who got his head chopped off?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
That'll kill you too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like, just think about like his Marie Antoinette, you know,
yeah.
Some guy that never bathes, like
right.
ever.
Right. And what's weird is I just read this. I was reading 1776 by David McCullough, mm-hmm. and he was 24 in 1775, Louis the 14th.
Uh-huh.
Everyone was 20. Everyone who took part in the Revolutionary War was like a baby,
mm-hmm.
like Hamilton and yeah. Burr and all those guys were 19, 20 years old.
Yeah.
But you don't think about it is King George was also in his early 20s in 1775, the King of England,
mm-hmm.
as was the King of France. Mm-hmm. And they're all just like, when I think about a 24-year-old being in charge.
Well, isn't that why in the Constitution they said the president has to be at least 30? That's why they wrote that in there.
Oh, is that one of the...
Like, you have to be 35. Also, okay. Also, so that there would never be a woman president, because I've never met a woman over 35 in my life.
Oh, I see what you did there.
No. But I think that's why they wrote it in, because they were like, this is crazy. Like,
this is crazy. Yeah, like, having babies rule our country.
Yeah, it's like... Yeah, I think it was basically Ben Franklin was like, I'm old enough to know that I can be absolutely convinced of something and a few years later know completely different to be true.
Yeah.
So, like, that was...
From all the accounts, it seemed like Ben Franklin was the only sane one of... Like, the rest of them were just kind of just... I mean, not that they weren't admirable qualities.
Right.
But he was the only one who was old enough to go, yeah, you know, this is a great idea and we got to do this. This is going to be great, but... Don't give away the baby with the bathwater, you know?
Well, I think it's like generationally too. It's like you just like, because I did spend time teaching. It's like you just like the thing I've learned is like some people just get it and some people don't. When I first started teaching, I mean, I was just a TA, but like when
right.
I first, you know, and I was young, I was dealing with people that were only like a few years younger than me. I was like
right.
21 and they were like 18, but like, I was very idealistic. I was like, you know, it's like everyone's like nurturing and the right kind of, you know, teaching or whatever. Like
should be able to get through to anyone.
Yeah. And after I started teaching, I came to be like, no, some people get it and some people don't. Cause it's like the class I was teaching was English 1, but I mean, honestly, there's a statistic that says like, if you pass English 1, you're most likely going to like go on through. But if you struggle there, you're probably going to struggle. I'm like, it's not because of the writing. It's because English 1 is where you learn critical thinking.
Okay.
But you can't teach critical thinking, but it's like that thing where I'd pull someone aside and be like, okay, well, what is the purpose of the paper?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, what are you trying to accomplish by telling me this information? Who
right.
are you talking to?
Okay.
Like trying to get a student to order their information.
Just try to find the right way. Right. If you could just find the right question sometimes, like I know
right.
people who teach and they're like, there are tricks to jumpstart a kid that has not been able to learn in this environment. And they're
right.
like, there are tricks that you can use. And if you, I guess if you teach long enough, I mean, I have never taught. I taught Head Start once for 16 weeks. I was 19. Anyway, and they were 16 and I was just slightly cooler than they were. And that's how, well, that was my power base.
Right.
Guess what? That's not a great power base. That's a terrible way to.
It was a huge struggle for me when I was teaching. But I think like the thing I came up with was like, I think just like every generation you get people, like you get your Stephen Fry's.
Yeah.
You know, you get that guy, you get your Benjamin Franklin and you just hope to God they're in a position of public trust.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like
and
I wish Stephen Fry
that.
Like held a political office. I really do. Like, but you know what I mean? It's
right.
like, I think it's like we just lucked out. Like we got one,
yeah.
like we got one in there. Like
yeah.
he was in the room.
Right.
Like,
there was a good guy in the room.
Yeah.
When it happens and there's so much, it's a hard thing to try to figure out I'm trying to say three things at once. Great okay. idea. Good idea. Here at
just,
minute 55.
Just relax. Just
relax. Just get into it, man.
Yeah.
But I think that there's so many, I love what you're doing where you're trying to figure out like the stories from the perspective. I think that that's
yeah.
so important. And it's almost, it makes it, it's much more compelling and it's a much better way to look at history than we have a tendency to. I mean, it's great to be able to rattle off dates and geography and,
yeah.
and all these different things, but to know the story behind the woman who actually, like there was a supposedly a woman it's apocryphal, but there's a woman in the Civil War or the Revolutionary War, who knows what war it was. But her husband was a cannon loader guy. He got shot and she had been there delivering a sandwich. Who knows what she was doing, but she took over for him.
Mm-hmm.
And her name, is a couple of different names, usually Molly something, but she's in any number of statues. There's any number of like in front of courthouses where there's a woman and there's a dead guy sitting next to her that's supposed to be her.
Yeah.
Her husband. And I want to know her story.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. There's so many stories like that too. Like I have a character like that comes into the novel because there's this woman, Jeanne Barret, that was the first woman to circumnavigate the globe.
Oh,
and
wow.
She did it on Bougainville's mission. She was the assistant, the valet to the botanist that was on board. And she was a woman in disguise. When they got to everyone, no one knew it. And they got to Tahiti and the natives in like 2 seconds were like,
oh, what's with the
you,
lady?
You fucked our girlfriend. Can we fuck yours? And like, but that's how it, it was discovered, you know?
Wow.
And so it's like written about, but like, I got interested in that. And like, there's, on Retronaut, there's a collection of photos, Civil War photos of women that were
women fighters.
Yeah. That were dressed as men, that were like passing as men.
That Sarah Vowell book, the semi-United States in the history of Marquis de Lafayette, whatever. There's a little anecdotal story of a French spy from the French and Indian War, from the Seven Years' War, who dressed as both a man and a woman, was a woman in the Russian court and was a spy, was a man in the British court.
Oh, that's so awesome.
And, right. And so they sent a playwright to ask, and he, she was constantly like threatening to give all these, and this was after the Seven Years' War, after the French and Indian War, and was threatening to turn these plans of how France was planning on invading London in 17, you know, back in 1760, whatever. But he still had the plans in his head, and he was like, well, if you guys bother me, I'm just going to tell the British what those plans were, and then that plan would be ruined forever. Uh-huh. And so the king sent this playwright to go kind of talk him or her down. And the conversation was fascinating with the spy, because the playwright said, you can come back, we'll promise you no jail time. And he was dressed as a man, and he said, well, I'd love that. No jail time would be great. And he said, we would give you your pension from when you served in the army and you could live out your life. And he goes, yeah, no jail time because I'm actually a woman. And the playwright was like, okay, well then the only part of our deal is you have to live out your life as a woman. And he goes, okay. So he does eventually go back to France, and the postmortem was he was actually physically a man. But he had lived out his life as a woman and had lived both as a man and a woman.
Right. I mean, that's got to be like,
that's
fascinating.
The greatest story in the world. Why is that a footnote in the story, Sarah Vowell? Please write a book about that guy.
But like, I mean, I think the reason I wanted to write these stories is because I feel like there are all these amazing women. And it's like, as a woman, I'm like, I want my heroes. Like, I want them back. You know, they are out there and I want them back. I want these stories to be told. I want to hear these stories about like, you know, the female genocide, AKA the Salem witch trials, you know, like that kind of thing where I'm like, like, I want all that stuff back, you know, and it feels like, you know, we're finally in a position to be able to like,
we might be able to unearth a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
Sovereign Sire, you have been a fascinating guest on the Dork Forest,
may
I say. So I love Sov, SOV.com.
Yes.
At Sovereign Sire on Twitter, Sovereign_Sire on Instagram and stuff like that. Your podcast is called Observations by Sovereign Sire on iTunes. And thank you so much for being on
the
show.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Rangers, you know the rules. Take care of each other out there.
My hat. They're dancing around my hat, my hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh, my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?